Welcome to episode 5 of the Views from 314 Feet podcast on the Pictureless Podcast Network. As always, it's Randy Wilkins, and I'm joined by Yankees beat reporter from The Athletic, Chris Kirshner. Chris, how are you?
Doing well. Beautiful day in New York. I'm not in Toronto. 70 degrees, sunny. Nothing to complain about. How are you doing?
Doing well. My allergies have not kicked in yet, so I'm actually able to go outside and enjoy the good weather until all the oak trees want to annihilate me for the next couple months. So I'm counting down to that. But right now I feel all right. I feel pretty good. It was Masters weekend. Did you watch the Masters? Did you watch Scottie Scheffler?
Yeah. Scottie's a machine.
Wait, hold on. Is it Scheffler or Scheffler? Sorry.
Scheffler.
Right. Scheffler. Sorry. I mispronounced his name. I'm sorry.
No, he's a machine. He solidified himself as the best player in the world once again. In his past like 4 starts, he has 3 wins and a second place finish. Mm. So he's tough to beat. Second green jacket for him. He's 27 years old. He's probably going to win several more by the time he's done.
Yeah, and is he the golfer where his wife is close to giving birth?
Yes. Yeah. So my one of my best friends actually works for the PGA Tour, and he told me that that story was like so overblown that he's not expected, his wife's not expected to give birth for like several weeks. So I don't know what the media was like running with there. I mean, obviously it's like he might have to like leave the Masters and he's in first place situation. But according to my friend, like she's still a couple weeks away from actually like her actual due date. So I don't know like how that story became like so overblown. Like that's all I saw on Twitter this past weekend is like, will his wife give birth? Will he leave the Masters? So it's like, I don't know.
No offense, but I'm not surprised that the media took something and then ran with it to create some drama.
I mean, it's a low-hanging fruit story. It's like, it's juicy. I mean, again, he was in first place like pretty much the entire weekend. So, of course, that's like a very interesting subplot. But, you know, according to him, it seems like she's not even that close. I don't know. I haven't had a kid, so maybe a few weeks away. Like, yeah, you can have it any day, but I don't know. I don't have a child.
Yeah, I don't have a child either. I just have a dog named Tim, and that's as close as I may ever come to having a kid. So I don't have to worry about Tim giving birth while we're doing the podcast or watching the Yankees. So I think I'm good on that end. Today is April 15th, so of course it's Jackie Robinson Day across all of Major League Baseball. I had the honor and privilege of telling Jackie's story and his role in the civil rights movement back in 2020 with Major League Baseball, and still one of the highlights of my career and being able to put him in a different light, especially with everything that was going on in 2020, was a pretty special experience for me. And obviously everybody will be wearing 42 today, and we can obviously have an entire podcast really digging into Jackie Robinson and his impact and how he's been portrayed and how people kind of use him in ways to make things seem better than they actually are. But your thoughts and feelings about Jackie Robinson Day and how MLB handles it.
Hold on. I think we're getting a call. is that Josh Donaldson on the line?
JD's not a fan, apparently.
I think it's awesome what they do for Jackie. You know, he's well deserving of having his number retired by every team. You can definitely make the case that he's the most influential athlete in the past 100 years, one of the most influential athletes for sure, just of what he did to change the game of baseball. So yeah, I mean, I think it's awesome. I think they, I honestly think they should do more. I don't know what to celebrate his legacy. I mean, they already do a lot, but you know, he's well deserving of every single accolade. He's well deserving of every mention that he gets every single year. Just because of what I said, he's changed baseball for the best.
Yeah. I mean, I'm in agreement with you. I don't think there's much more to say about it. He's obviously an icon and changed everything, really. I think he and Curt Flood are probably two of the most influential athletes of the last 100 years. Obviously there are more, but I think in baseball and Major League Baseball specifically, Jackie Robinson and Curt Flood have an impact that go well beyond their sport and their league. I mean, they completely altered the landscape in two different ways, and Curt Flood looked up to Jackie Robinson, and Jackie had a profound impact on Curt Flood. So, you know, I think there's a very clear lineage between the two when we talk about just global impacts. Those two players, those two guys stand out immediately. So happy Jackie Robinson Day. Hope all the games are good. One day I want to get my hand on one of those on-field 42 jerseys. I've always wanted one of those. So
I was trying to get the Nike Dunks that came out, I think.
Yeah.
Either last year or 2 years. Yeah. The ones that had like all the, it's like Dodger blue, like all the 42 numbers on it. I was looking on StockX actually a couple of days ago. They're like $400.
Oh yeah. They're crazy. Yeah. The resale is crazy.
And yeah. I always lose like the draws on sneakers. It's like impossible to win.
We all do.
Yeah, it's impossible. I don't know who wins. Together.
The box.
I have no idea who wins. I've won once. Yeah. I won the high top Travis Scott's that I sold. Nice. Yeah, I sold those. Like I didn't really have any intention of keeping them.
Yeah.
So I think the original price was like $150 or $170. I don't remember, but I sold it for like $900. I was like,
yeah,
perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect. Yeah.
I mean, that's also its own podcast, navigating sneakers. but let's stick to the Yankees. Let's get to why everyone listens to us. And thank you for listening and supporting us. The numbers are doing very good. So we are very appreciative of that. And we're recording this on Monday morning. Obviously, there will be a game played between tonight and when you listen to this. We come out on Tuesdays. But I think that we can talk a little bit about the Cleveland series in the context of how the Yankees move forward and potential things that they need to start paying some attention to, just to see as they round out their roster and look for things to improve upon as the season goes on. I think looking back, especially at the final game of the Cleveland series, you start to see a lot of reasons why they're off to a great start, and you see some reasons for why they need to not be concerned, but start paying attention to certain aspects of their game. And I want to preface this conversation by saying, I think the Yankees have played to their record. I think that they have played to 12-4, given that Glaber has basically been a zero. Judge has been inconsistent by his standards, at least in the power category. They don't have Gerrit Cole. There are a lot of reasons for why one would think that they shouldn't be 12-4, but I do think their play and their compete level, as Aaron Boone always likes to reference, justifies a 12-4 record. Like it should be even better, to be quite honest. They should have won that game yesterday. So I think that the Yankees are really good. They're off to a really good start. I think it's legitimate. I don't think it's 2022, even though I thought that team was good. I'm not sure why people always look at that as some fluke year. They lost to a better team in the ALCS. That's what happened that year. And guys got hurt, and Judge was having a magical year, but they were still a good team. That's my feeling on it. But that the end of the Cleveland game yesterday on Sunday reveals a lot of good and bad. So I think we should start with the good, and that's the top of the ninth with Volpe facing Clase. And the inning starts off with Trevino getting a nice hit. I wasn't really expecting him to just drive that ball like that against Clase. And then the at-bat with Volpe. Volpe gets the big double. The outfielder misplayed it, but I don't think he was making that play anyway. Volpe crushed that ball. I think if he pulls it, that ball's out. He hit it really well. So what did you think of that ninth inning? What did you think of the Yankees' comeback? Did you think that they could come back against Clase? I know that they have a pretty good history with him and kind of getting to him in previous matchups. What did you think of the comeback in the ninth?
Yeah, I mean, Clase is one of the hardest closers to hit off of. I know that the Yankees have had success against him in the past couple of years, but it doesn't matter. Like, he's electric. It's anytime you throw a 100 mile per hour pitch that has movement on it. I mean, like Judge said yesterday on Sunday, it's like near impossible to hit a pitch like that. That's triple digits and has movement. And like you said, Volpe struck that ball. Yeah, like the right fielder had a poor route to it, but you know, I think that ball probably gets down anyway, just the, like the placement of where he hit the ball. I also just think it's another moment for Volpe that shows like how better of a hitter he is this year. Last year, I mean, he's probably striking out against Clase. He's nasty, and Volpe last year was striking out like at once every three at bats. I mean, he's just an incredible player this year. It's not even just hitting. He's gotten faster. Like, his sprint speed is better this year. I mean, we talked about his defense in prior episode. Like, everything that's hit to him, it feels like he's making the play. And then just at the plate, he's like unstoppable right now. So I think that is a very good sign, especially if once Judge, you know, goes nuclear. I expect him to go nuclear at some point. That's just what Judge does. But if you have a top three of Volpe, if he continues this pace, he's going to fall off at some point. He has like a 211 WRC plus. I mean, he's not going to be two times better than the league average. So I assume he's going to fall off, but just how much, I don't know. But you have him at the leadoff spot. You have Judge. I mean, you have Soto in the two spot, and then Judge. That's a really great 1-2-3. That's one of the best 1-2-3s across the sport. You know, you look at the Braves, they have a really good 1-2-3. The Dodgers, obviously, with Ohtani and Betts and Freeman. But the Yankees have to be right there, especially if all three of those guys are rolling at the same time. So I think that just that moment alone said a lot about Volpe and just the start of his season.
I also think it's another reflection of the Soto impact. And I think you speak about Volpe, and I think a lot of it is physical improvements, but I also think his IQ and awareness on a major league level is getting better, because having Soto on deck and Class A not throwing strikes at the beginning of the at bat, like not being able to establish strike one in that at bat, I think was crucial. And I think Volpe took advantage of it. And you mentioned Volpe probably striking out in that situation. And I think part of that is trying to make things happen in those situations and not being able to control an at bat and possibly fishing from one of those pitches that was out of the strike zone early on in the at bat, just to see if he can make something happen, and maybe a little bit of anxiety or a little bit too much of that young, inexperienced energy. And he took those two pitches knowing that they were balls out of his hands and put himself in a position where he could have a 2-0 count. And he swung at the 2-0 fastball that was a meatball, you know, by location only, not by stuff. I mean, that pitch was nasty because, like you said, it's 100 with movement. And he fouled it off. And it was like, I'm sitting on my couch and I'm saying, he's throwing this pitch again. He does not want to walk Volpe to get the Soto. And I hope Volpe knows that. And Volpe clearly knew that. And he saw another fastball that was out over the plate that he could drive the other way. And he put a great swing on it. So I think the combination of Soto's influence on being on deck, Volpe understanding that. And once he got that 2-0 fastball, it was like, he's going to throw me another one because he doesn't want to go 3-1. You know, just because I'm there, and also because you don't want to put another runner on base with Soto and Judge on, you know, back to back. So I think it was just a great at bat that not only showed his physical improvement, but his IQ on the major league level is clearly improving, and he's calm and he's thinking through at bats better. So I thought that was really encouraging and a great sign. I agree he's going to fall off a little bit at some point, but I think he's clearly set a baseline of what the rest of his season could be if he stays healthy and has some consistency throughout the season. So let's jump to the 10th, because that's when all hell broke loose for some reason. So we're going to talk about Verdugo in a little bit. We're going to focus on him a little bit more. But I was astounded that it was second and third with one out. The Yankees have all the momentum. They could clearly break the game open. And he hits into a double play, second and third, one out. And there were so many moments in that 10th inning that you can point to for why the Yankees lost. And the Glaber play is the one that everybody's fixating on. With good reason, was not a good play. He totally messed it up. But I also think that double play had a lot to do with it. There was just a huge opportunity to really break the game open. And I thought it was a poor at bat, to be quite honest. Fundamentally, just bad. I just thought it was a terrible at bat. What did you think of Verdugo's at bat, the double play, how the Yankees kind of went about doing that top half of the 10th?
Yeah, I mean, you just got to put more runs on the board, especially in that situation. With Verdugo, you know, just like watching over, I have access to this like site that I can see multiple like replay angles. So I was just watching the camera that's like on top of the stadium, like behind home plate, to get a good look at it. So from what I saw, it looked like Verdugo like slowed down in between home and first. And it looked like because he was scared that his head was going to come off, because the first baseman comes home with the ball, obviously, and Verdugo like kind of gets out of the way, which slowed him down. I know Verdugo was getting a lot of hate online about just why didn't he run. I think it was because of that. I think it was because he thought the ball was going to hit him if he just continued running. But it's kind of an encapsulation of what has happened with Verdugo through the first 16 games. He's been hitting a lot of ground balls, weak ground balls to the right side. So, and that was just another one and just happened to be in a really big moment of the game. I don't think there's really anything else to it. That's just what he's been doing. For the first 16 games, he's been hitting a lot of ground balls. He's not hitting the ball hard. You know, right now on Monday afternoon, he's in the 6th percentile in average exit velocity. He's just not hitting the ball hard at all. And there's nothing else to really say about it. It was an unfortunate moment in a big spot of the game. If they get even one run or in that situation, who knows, the Yankees may win that game. But yeah, I don't know what else to say about it. Just a rough moment in a big spot.
Yeah, so let's get to the bottom of the 10th. And this is where I think the larger picture stuff comes into play. I think the top of the 9th with Volpe, I think, is a good sign for them. They always compete. They're going to be in the game. It's something that Aaron Boone stresses. So I think when we talk about this game in a bigger picture context, that's the takeaway from that stretch of time. But the bottom of the 10th is revealing, I won't say cracks because we're just getting started. I think everybody's still laying a foundation for their season. But I will say that it's an emerging trend that we picked up on early, and we mentioned it in our last episode. And I think as time is going on, more and more people are starting to realize what's happening on the pitching side and the infield defense side. So the first big play of that inning that kind of led to the downfall, I guess, is the Josh Naylor ground ball to second base. Now, I want to make something clear. People have been getting on Glaber. I get it. I understand why. But if you look at this play, Glaber makes a fantastic play to get to the ball and get the ball to Volpe. And it wasn't a perfect throw because of the degree of difficulty from Glaber's play. But it's a play that Volpe should complete. And I think if you would ask Volpe, he would say, I should have turned a double play. So you have that play, and then you have the infield drawn in. Gleyber completely botches the ground ball, doesn't get an out, doesn't get the out at home, doesn't get the out at first. And we all know how the game ends. So let's just talk about that this entire sequence in the context of any concerns regarding infield defense and the pitching staff's continued inability to not only not get strikeouts, but also they're not getting really swing and miss either. They're just not missing bats either early in the count, late in the count, at bat to at bat. They're just not getting them. So this entire sequence in the bottom of the 10th, what are your takeaways from that? What do you think that this is going to be an issue moving forward, both the infield defense and the lack of swing and miss from the pitching staff, particularly the bullpen? How do you feel that moment can play out in other games, other moments, week to week, month to month?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll start with the lack of strikeouts. I think we talked about it in the last episode, but the bullpen hasn't done a good job with striking out hitters, and that's the number one result you want out of your pitchers. You want strikeouts, and even the starters, they just haven't been striking out a lot of hitters. But the bullpen especially, I think I said it in the last episode, but you know, who's the guy that you want to turn to in a spot where you just need a strikeout and it sets up a double play or whatever, you get out of the inning, whatever it might be. I just don't know who that guy is. I think it's Nick Birdy, but you know, his command has been shaky at best, I'd say. He definitely has electric stuff. He can definitely strike out hitters. But again, if it's a big spot, do you trust him to throw strikes? I don't know. And outside of Birdy, like all of their relievers have been under the major league average for strikeout rate for relievers. I think Ian Hamilton's the closest to the major league average, but he's below. Clay Holmes hasn't really been missing bats either. You know, I get Clay is a, you know, ground ball pitcher, and he's one of the best at generating weak contact. But, you know, you go up and down that bullpen, Caleb Ferguson, Victor Gonzalez, Luke Weaver, those guys aren't strikeout guys. And it kind of showed itself in the 10th inning. You know, it starts off with Jose Ramirez. Ferguson gets him in a two-strike count. Ramirez fouls off six straight pitches because he doesn't have a put-away pitch. And you know, in that battle with such a good hitter like Ramirez, most of the time the hitter's going to win. He's too good. And then he pokes it into center field for a single. But yeah, the Naylor play specifically, I think a lot of people have missed the fact that Gleyber made that play. And Gleyber did his job on that play. That ball was struck at 107 miles an hour. That easily could have gone into right field. And, you know, it's no outs. And the Guardians have first and second. And they just sort of run. But Gleyber makes the play. And to Ferguson's, you know, credit, he did his job on that play. Like, he generated the ground ball. Yeah, it was well struck. But, you know, the infielder makes the play. It should have been two outs. And the Yankees probably, you know, go on and win the game. But you can see when Gleyber turned to throw the ball to Volpe, Volpe gets down on a knee, catches it. When he goes to make the transfer, he, you know, the ball drops on the ground. And right after, you can see Volpe's pissed off, like he slaps his glove because he knows, like, you know, he should have made that. But then moving forward, you know, it just continues. You know, when Will Brennan hit the ball, Gleyber infield's in, they're trying to cut Naylor down at the plate. It just seemed like Gleyber was trying to throw the ball without having control of the ball. That's ultimately what happened. It wasn't that the ball was, you know, hit hard. It was 89 miles an hour. Not that difficult of a play for a major leaguer. But even then, like, he throws it home and he doesn't get an out at first. You know, he had plenty of time. It was Brennan was like 15 feet away from first base. You know, so I highly doubt that you know, Glaber could have gotten Naylor down after he bobbled it like three times, but he could have just taken the at first. I guess in that moment, like, you're panicking, like, you realize right. that you messed up. So you're trying to, like, you know, fire the ball to home and hope that you can get him out. But, you know, obviously it wasn't going to happen. But I think it's just a moment again where the pitchers aren't missing bats. You invite contact. And when you invite contact, you know, these things can happen.
So I want to talk a little bit more about the bullpen, because a lot of people have pointed to the bullpen ERA, top five, whatever it is at the moment. And I always kind of look at bullpen ERA with a side eye, because I don't think that tells the entire story, because that only covers the runners that they put on base. It doesn't cover inherent runners. It doesn't really paint a great picture for relievers, in my opinion. And over the winter, there were a bunch of guys that I wanted the Yankees to sign. They didn't sign any of them. They didn't bring back Wandy. People, you know, you love Wandy because he's T.O. Wandy, but if you look at the numbers, you could see some justification for why they wouldn't bring him back. But there were plenty of guys in the market that are strikeout guys that would have been nice additions to the pen, and the Yankees didn't bring any of them in. That's fine. And a lot of people, and I think this is becoming, we're going too far to the extreme now, where they say, well, you can just get anybody. Matt Blake will fix them. That's what the Yankees do. You know, just give any old guy who has an arm and can throw the ball a little bit to Matt Blake, and he's going to make them this unbelievable reliever. And Matt Blake is a fantastic pitching coach, yada, yada, yada. I'm not totally sure this bullpen is good. And if you look at the numbers early on, there are a lot of numbers and rankings where you can say this is a mid bullpen at best. K per nine, they're last. Expected FIP, middle of the pack. FIP, middle of the pack, if not worse. The one thing that they do well is limit the home runs. So they're not really giving up the long ball, which is great. I think there are some positives as a collective that they're good at, but there are a lot of numbers that suggest that this bullpen has some issues. And I'm just concerned that because they don't have the strikeout guys, and, you know, we've talked about this already, but there isn't somebody you can rely on to just say, I'm getting this out. That was Loaiza, and he's obviously not going to be there anymore. And it just feels like the inning Sunday is an encapsulation of what's to come, especially if the infield defense isn't on point. And the infield defense has been kind of surprisingly, like, not very good, but I think that'll correct itself. I'm not sure if they have the actual personnel to improve upon their numbers that they've established so far to this point. And it feels like there's going to be more games where these situations can go one way or the other, just because of the personnel available. And the thing that pops up in my head is at some point they're going to have to bring in one or two guys that can just get a strikeout, because I'm not convinced that the bullpen is as good as people would like to say at the beginning of the season. Agree, disagree?
Like, no, I agree with you. I agree with you. I mean, you know, just especially with your comment about, you know, bullpen ERA, like, it's not a great stat to use to measure how good your bullpen is. There's just plenty of situations that, you know, could lead to a high ERA, low ERA. It's just not a great stat to use. But yeah, I mean, like, looking at the deeper metrics, there's definitely some stats that, like, make you say, are we sure, like, this bullpen is good? Like, what you're saying, you know, their expected FIP, you mentioned it before, but they're, like, fourth to last in that stat. And they're in the middle of a pack in regular FIP. They're not striking out hitters. I just don't know, like, when you look at the bullpen as a whole, you know, outside of Holmes, like, who's the number one guy you're like, all right, he's coming in and nothing's going to happen. I guess it's Ian Hamilton. You know, Hamilton's obviously a success story. Signed him out of spring training last year, non-roster invitee. What, not much was expected out of him. But, you know, losing Loaisiga definitely hurts, because you know for sure when he comes in, he's going to throw gas and he's going to look electric, and he has strikeout stuff. There's just not that one guy outside of Holmes where you're like, he's coming in and I feel good about the situation. You know, Hamilton's had great success, but again, who knows if he's going to be this kind of pitcher for the rest of his time with the Yankees, just because of the fact that he had no prior success before joining the Yankees. You know, Ferguson's looked shaky. Gonzalez is just a lefty specialist. You know, I guess when you look forward a few months down the road, you know, Efros is going to come back. I think Efros could be really good, but you know, he's coming off Tommy John. Same thing with Lou Trevino. I think he can be really good. He was good in 2022, but he's also coming off of Tommy John, so who knows what he's going to do. Tommy Canley should be back at some point, but even with Tommy, he's hurt right now. He's probably going to get hurt again. That's just what Tommy does. He gets hurt. So they're probably going to have to, at some point, add relievers, whether it's at the trade deadline or even within. You know, they have Clayton Beter, who is starting down there. Cody Poteet looked awesome in his spot start on Saturday. You know, I think he could be an option. I don't think he's going to be a starter for the Yankees at any point other than, you know, we need somebody to start, and he's the option. But, you know, who knows? Like, maybe he can be a multi-inning reliever. I think his stuff is really good. So, I mean, they have internal options, but that also requires moves to, you know, make space, and sometimes that's difficult to do.
So we're not trying to be doom and gloom. I think the Yankees, like I said before, have earned their 12-4 record. I think they're a good team. I think they're going to be a contender, all those things. It's just trying to take these early moments and see where the Yankees can improve upon to be an even better team moving forward. So the bullpen feels like one of those areas that they're going to have to address at some point. And after this break, we'll get a little bit more into Alex Verdugo and his impact on the team thus far. We'll be back right after this break. And we're back. It's the Views from 314 Feet podcast. It's Randy. It's Chris. Just wrapped up a good conversation about the bullpen and a little bit about the infield defense. And we want to transition to get into a little bit more on one particular player. That is one, Alex Verdugo. And we actually we're going to do this a little different just because we have this segment, and because all of you are so smart, you knew that we were going to talk about Alex Verdugo. So we're going to mention a mailbag question to start off this segment. And it comes from Tim Jennings. Thank you for emailing us, Tim. Do you guys think the Yankees should start benching Verdugo and see if maybe Grisham can provide more offense if he doesn't start hitting more consistently? He's had a couple of big hits, but it seems like a lot of his at-bats end up being weak ground balls to the right side. So we mentioned the weak ground balls to the right side. We can get more in depth with this. But the first part of his question, should they start giving some at-bats to Grisham? What do you think about that?
No, because Grisham can't hit either. I think Grisham's a worse hitter than Verdugo. So there's, I mean, I'm being honest.
Yeah.
There's no reason to bench Verdugo for Grisham. And also, if Verdugo is benched, I don't know who's playing left field, because Grisham's a center fielder. You know, they're probably not moving Judge to left. They're not going to move Soto to left. So I don't even know. It's not like a equal comparison when you're talking about, you know, benching one for the other, just because, you know, the outfield alignment is going to be off. I guess you can put Judge in at DH, but then Stanton's out and Stanton's been hitting okay. So yeah, I mean, like right now, no, I wouldn't consider that an option.
Yeah, I wouldn't consider that an option either. I would like Grisham to get some more at bats just because I want to see if there's something that the Yankees have done with him to maybe help him. But certainly the game on Sunday with the two double plays didn't help his cause. And I think Verdugo's doing enough defensively to justify him getting everyday at bats. You know, I think if he was struggling defensively and not hitting, then you have a reason to start mixing some things up a little bit. But I think Verdugo's been contributing defensively. He gives good energy. And like you said, I also don't know who's going to play left field. I mean, I don't think you're going to put Judge out there. So I'm going to use this word, but I don't mean it in a negative manner. I think they're kind of stuck with Verdugo in left. And I don't mean that in a way to criticize him. I just mean they just don't have another option really that's strong enough to consider moving him or splitting up some at bats. But I do think that it's a worthy question when we talk about his offense. And you had mentioned,
I mean, even with his offense, like he has a 112 WRC plus, meaning he's 12% better than the average major league hitter. Like, yeah, he's, you know, he has a lot of ground balls, but, you know, he's walking a lot. Again, he's not hitting the ball hard, but he's still doing stuff to get on base. I think for him, it's just a matter of can he start pulling putting the ball in the air? I think that would go a long way. I mean, his BABIP is 208, which is incredibly low, which would also suggest that he's also running into some bad luck. So maybe his numbers do turn. It's the same thing that we talked about with Judge on Thursday's episode. You know, Judge has been running into a lot of bad luck. Verdugo, just based off that number alone, is running into a lot of bad luck. He's not going to have a 208 BABIP for the rest of the season. So I think for him, it's just continuing to put him out there. And also, I think people have to realize that when you compare Verdugo to what they had last year in left field, he is way better already. Way better.
Yeah,
he actually
sure.
catches pop-ups.
Yeah.
You know, last year, it was an adventure anytime the ball was hit to left field. He's getting on base. Nobody was getting on base in left field last season. So he's already made such a – even if you think he's been bad or, you know, below average or below your expectations – also consider the fact that left field last year was such a disaster and he's been fine. So I think there's no reason to panic or criticize if that's what you're feeling, just because of the fact that, you know, he has been an above average hitter by the numbers. And I do think that his luck will turn at some point. And also his energy, like you mentioned, he's been beloved in the clubhouse so far. Again, it's mid-April. We'll see what happens. You know, it hasn't always worked out for Verdugo in his previous spots, but right now, like the guys in the clubhouse really like him, and they've enjoyed the energy that he's brought. So that's also something that, you know, should be talked about, because baseball's so long, and you want guys who are the energy providers, and he's, you know, one of the top two or three that are doing that.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, and especially when you make the comparison to whatever that was last year. I mean, they didn't have a major league outfielder out there for what felt like the entire season. I mean, I don't know who, and I can't remember who played left field last year that felt like a major league caliber player, at least in 2023. I mean, Jake Bowers couldn't catch a fly ball. IKF was out there. Oswaldo. Pereira.
Franchi. Willie Calhoun. Yeah. Billy McKinney. Yeah. It was
Billy
just a
McKinney.
Revolving door. Aaron Hicks.
Well, I don't want to mention that man's name ever again. old school Yankees Twitter people remember me just getting on Hicks even when he was good. I mean, I was just not an Aaron Hicks fan. Never was, never will be. I appreciate some of the big moments, but yeah, nah. Aaron Hicks and I'm sure he's a very nice guy.
He is a nice guy. I enjoy talking to him.
Yeah, I mean, it's not personal at all, but just the fan player relationship there, the little one that existed. I'm not, I wasn't the biggest fan of Aaron Hicks. So I, I don't even think of him at this point. So yeah, in that sense, Verdugo's been a huge upgrade. I mean, there's no argument there. There's no issue. I'd like to see him hit the ball hard though. I mean, I think there's a reason why his BABIP is so low. I mean, I just don't think he's making really good contact yet.
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean, he's not squaring a ball up. You know, it's just, I think he's interesting because he's one of the guys that's having good at bats and like is not having much to show for it. And I think if Glaber was hitting better, a lot of people would be paying more attention to the quality of contact with Verdugo. And I think because Glaber is there and he's not doing anything, to be quite honest, offensively, I think Verdugo, not that he's getting a pass, because again, he's being productive and he has a couple home runs. And again, this is not meant to like dump on him. It's just for the sake of conversation. I would like to see a little bit more hard contact and scoring the ball up. And it just, the double play, like you said, was just kind of, you know, it's a play, bad situation, you know, bad moment in a big situation. But I also think we've seen a lot of that. You know, it's just a lot of double plays, like you said, a lot of balls on the ground. And even his hits outside of his home runs, it's not driving the ball. Like they're almost like flares. You know what I mean? So it's just, I guess my thing with Verdugo is he should be playing. He's being productive. I would just like him to hit the ball harder with more consistency and start squaring the ball up. And then I think he'll be fine.
He's also usually around league average in exit velocity. So I assume that will bounce back at some point. Cause like I said before, you know, he's in the sixth percentile. So that's extremely low for him. So I assume that will bounce back at some point.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm not panicking or overly concerned about him. I just think that when we're kind of going through players in the lineup, because I think it's easy to talk about Glaber. Glaber's struggling. Glaber's not off to a good start. It's obvious. I don't think there's much to say there. Rizzo, I don't know what to make of Rizzo, to be quite honest. I don't know what's going on. I think the easy thing to say is the concussion and, you know, some lingering effects, even though he's healthy or he says he's healthy. And I mean, to your knowledge, nobody has expressed any concern.
No,
but he's like, I don't know what's going on with him. I think we all tweeted at the same time, like something's going on with him when he had all those errors, and he's getting some hits, but he still looks like he's playing in slow motion. And I don't know, man. Like, I don't know what to think of Rizzo. And I know we talked about him last week, but even after this series, it's still like, I don't know what's going on with him.
Yeah, it's bizarre. I mean, the defense alone is just very bizarre. The plays in Sunday's game were very strange. You know, Cabrera makes a throw across the diamond, the ball, like, it was low, but it should have been caught. Like, it was in his glove, and it just dropped it. And then a weak ground ball, he boots that. And then, you know, just in the previous couple of weeks, there have been several plays that are like, what is going on here? You know, the ball goes through his legs in the Marlins series, didn't make the tag in Arizona. There was, I think, another play in Arizona where he booted the ball but recovered and got the out. It's just been a lot of weird stuff with Rizzo. Like, he's had good results so far. Like, he has a 115 WRC plus, but he's doing that and just not hitting the ball hard at all. Like, you know, we just talked about Verdugo's very low BABIP. Rizzo right now has a 340 and his career average is 280. So yeah, he's, you know, that would suggest that he's getting pretty lucky with the hits he's had. And again, I think that's just due in part because a lot of his hits have dunked in, you know, shallow outfield. He's still yet to barrel a baseball, which is very concerning because he's usually one of the better ones across baseball. with barreling up a baseball. He just hasn't done that yet. I guess, you know, the Yankees would tell you that, oh, he's fine. He's having good results, but I think at some point that's going to come crashing down, especially if he continues to just not hit the ball very hard.
I'm with you. I mean, let's shift quickly to something that's positive. And I think that's Aaron Judge. That ball he hit Sunday was destroyed. And I think, you know, there was a lot of talk about, as he hurt, and we talked about it as well, but I think he's starting to get his feet into the ground a little bit. And you had mentioned this earlier, just the 1-2-3 of Volpe, Soto, and Judge. I think moving forward, that's what it has to be. I mean, I don't, even when LeMahieu comes back, I mean, I think Volpe has to be the leadoff hitter just because of that,
yes,
the dynamics that they all provide. I mean, that's a lethal trio if Volpe keeps it up and can make a huge difference. And I remember the last couple of years that the Yankees have been successful, they always get to an early lead, or at least there was always a threat, it felt like, in every game that they could put 1, 2, 3 runs on the board as soon as the game started. And good luck to a lot of pitchers trying to get through that trio if Volpe keeps it up.
He has to stay there. I know Boone loves hitting DJ in the leadoff spot, but you can't move Volpe. If Volpe is going to continue hitting and getting on base, he's the leadoff guy. That's it. Like, that's what you want out of your leadoff guy. He's getting on base. He's making good contact. You want that guy to have as many at-bats as possible. He provides a speed element that DJ doesn't have in front of Soto and Judge. You know, all right, let's throw in an example. You know, Volpe's on first base. He walked or got a single. Soto's up. Soto hits one in the gap. Volpe's going to probably score or has a good chance.
Right.
DJ's not scoring. He's not fast.
No.
So I mean, that's also something to consider with Volpe. Just like you just mentioned, you know, usually teams who jump out to early leads end up winning the game most of the time. I just don't see how they could move him off out of the leadoff spot when DJ comes back. You just can't do it. Right now, you just can't. And I think this Toronto series is going to be a nice, I don't know if test is the right word, but, you know, if Volpe continues to play well, especially in a series against a division rival, I don't know how Boone can justify moving Volpe out of that number one spot, even when DJ comes back.
I don't think he can. And I think this version of Boone will probably agree with us and say, we're not touching this. I think if we're talking about a year or two ago, you know, there's a loyalty there. There's a commitment to a certain approach. It feels like Boone this year is like, nah, man, if you're hot, you're going to play. And if this is working, this is what we're going with, and we're not going to mess around with it. So I think I would like to think that they'll keep this alignment and this lineup moving forward as long as it keeps clicking. Now, I have one question about this, and I thought about this a couple times during the Cleveland series. We both agree that this should be the top three in the lineup. I'm curious, do you try to have Volpe steal bases, or do you just say, I have Soto and Judge the next two batters? Let me not mess this up and just let them hit, and it limits Volpe's stolen base opportunities or stolen bases that important. Where do you feel, or how do you feel about using Volpe's legs to get in scoring position once he's on first? And do you think that in some ways it kind of limits his opportunity to steal some bags?
I believe I've asked this question to Boone and Judge in the past. I don't know if I've asked them this season, but I definitely remember bringing it up last year, especially when Volpe was hitting ninth and, you know, Judge is coming up, or whoever, DJ, especially in the second half, DJ was good. The answer that I got was no. Like, Volpe, if he can run, he can run. So I don't know if that would limit his opportunities. You know, obviously, like, the conservative approach would be, like you said, Soto's coming up, Judge is coming up. You don't want to get out on the bases. But I think Volpe's a really good base runner. I think he's smart on the bases. I think he knows when he can take his chances. So I don't think, at least right now, that it would limit his opportunities to steal bases. I mean, if anything, you probably want him to be a little aggressive because those guys are putting the ball in play. So if Volpe's on second base and, you know, Soto's, you know, getting a single, that's 1-0 right there for the Yankees. So I think that it shouldn't limit his opportunities. And I think the Yankees understand that sometimes being aggressive, especially on the base paths, is a good thing at the right times. And I think Volpe has, you know, free rein to, you know, steal when he thinks it's the right opportunity.
Well, that's good. I mean, I don't think Volpe should lose that dynamic to his game. I mean, I think it just makes that top three even more lethal. I mean, if you have Volpe on second with Soto and Judge up, I mean, you just feel good about their chances to score at least one run at the, you know, early on in the game. So we will go to this break. We'll come out of it. We'll have your mailbag questions. We have a few to get through. And we'll start doing that right after this break. Welcome back to the Views from 314 Feet podcast. It's Randy. It's Chris. Tim is trying his best to get in the shot. And he probably has thoughts on all your mailbag questions. So we'll ask him at some point as well. He might not like your questions. So I'm just warning you all now. All right. So first question. From the OG of the Views from 314 Feet blog, Steven Tidings. Steven, what's up? Follow him on Twitter. He has a good question, as always. Is there any merit to disrupting Beeter as a starter and bringing him up as a potential strikeout guy in the bullpen now? Seems like more of a late season move, but the team could really use the boost of a reliever with some swing and miss. I guess same applies to Will Warren, but they seem more willing to give up on Beeter starting based on his opening day assignment. Any thoughts on Beeter being a potential call-up to help out?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what Steven said. I think it's more later in the season. Again, I think it's the lack of strikeouts is an issue right now. But again, we're in mid-April. So if it's October or if it's September – and you want to see what Beeter can do out of the bullpen in an extended run, sure, you probably bring him up then. But I don't think it's necessary right now. I think that for the Yankees, you know, extracting as much value out of a player in a starting role is more important than bringing up Beeter now in mid-April to just get, you know, some strikeouts because the Yankees don't have any in the bullpen. That's my take. I think it's later in the season. If Beeter's still performing well, bring him up and have him ready to go by October.
I agree. And this is going to be kind of funny to ask you this question because we're doing a podcast on the Yankees. But you're around a team. You know how they normally operate. You know how there's a lot of outside noise from fans, media, sports talk, radio, all those factors. But you're actually on the inside. You know the pulse of the team top to bottom better than most people because you're there. Do you think the Yankees are even thinking about the stuff that we're talking about? Like, to them, is it just like, okay, we lost this game. You know, some things are happened, but we have another game. We're just moving on. And then at some point, whatever they're benchmark spots are in the schedule, they'll start evaluating it? Or do you think that they're so in tune and so focused on every game that they're noticing the things that we're noticing?
I mean, I think they're, well, I know they're way less emotional than fans. Like, well, I don't think they're, I don't think they're panicking over Sunday's loss on April 14th, you know, against a good team that may make the playoffs. But I mean, I they're definitely evaluating like every single game and, you know, keeping up with the trends, like who's playing well, who's not, what needs to be improved, what's, you know, bullshit, as Brian Cashman said in the GM meetings in November. But yeah, I mean, I think the sample size right now is so small. So I don't think they're getting concerned about like trends right now. Obviously, I think some things are catching their eye, but I don't think they're like making sweeping decisions off of 16 games, if that answers the question.
Yeah, that definitely answers it. I was just curious in terms of the rate at which they evaluate their own performances. And I'm sure they're noticing what we're noticing. They know more than all of us know. So I'm sure that they're seeing these things. I was just more curious about, is this something that they pay attention to early on? And it feels like they are, but of course, there's no panic, nor should there be. I mean, they're 12-4. You know what I mean? Like, if there was a team that needed... Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think I should ask Boone, Blake, and Rousen just like what they consider like a good sample size for hitters, for decisions, for pitchers. I think that's something I should ask the next time I speak with them, because I think it is interesting to know and to give fans insight of it's 16 games. Like the Yankees actually look at, you know, chunks of their season in 30 game sample size or whatever it might be. I don't know what their sample size is, but I think it's a good question to ask.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it would just help fans to understand, you know, what some of their benchmarks are, so people can hopefully align with some of those. So, all right. We get a question about Jason Dominguez every week, and I intentionally push them to the side because he's not playing. He's not on rehab assignment. We don't know what's going on, but we're getting so many Jason questions. We'll ask one this week. So from John Murata, hey fellas, if there are no injuries by then, man, if there's no injuries by then, wow, they might win a million games. How do you think the team will handle Jason Dominguez's return? With Grisham getting very little run so far, do you see him being traded midseason? Would Verdugo then become the fourth outfielder? In all likelihood, an injury will solve this puzzle, but if health prevails, it'll be interesting to see how the team manages the situation. So let's talk a little bit about Jason and how he factors into everything and kind of project a little bit down the road. What do you think about John's question and how Jason factors into everything?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair question, especially after what Jason did in 2023. But I think people just get carried away with what Jason did in 2023. Like, he came up when the Yankees very clearly gave up on the season. I think he was hitting like third some games. Like, he's no chance he's hitting third in 2024 if everything stays, you know, the same. I just think I think the eight games that Jason showed just made every fan like lose their minds. And we had talked about it before we went on air, but you know, in 2022, the playoffs, Harrison Bader looked like he was Aaron Judge in five games. And then Bader gets DFA'd the following season because he was just not a good hitter. So I think it's great that Dominguez showed potential in those eight games, but I don't even know if it's a given that he is with the major league team when he's healthy. Like, I think they like their alignment right now in the outfield. I think they like Verdugo still, Judge and Soto. If those guys are playing well, which I expect they should, and I expect Verdugo to, you know, be at least adequate, I don't see how there's space for Dominguez to come up. And if Stanton's still healthy and if Stanton's performing to relative success, I don't know if there's space for Dominguez to be on this roster when he returns. And I think a lot of fans are just putting Dominguez into the 26-man roster in Penn when he returns from Tommy John. I would push back against that. I don't know if they are going to do that. Maybe I'm wrong, but again, the sample size for Dominguez is so small, and also he's so young still. You know, next year when you look ahead, Grisham is a free agent, Verdugo is a free agent. There's going to be space for Dominguez to be on the roster in 2025. I think there's definitely a role for him in 24, but I think some things have to go sideways for that to happen.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't know where he fits right now. And I like to remind people that Tommy John surgery for a position player does not have the same guarantee of return to previous level of performance as we might expect for a pitcher. And the Yankees already have two very recent examples of this. Both Aaron Hicks and Didi Gregorius had Tommy John surgery, and neither player were the same afterwards. You know, Didi definitely fell off, and Aaron Hicks wasn't able to play at the level of consistency with his level of play than prior to the injury. And there aren't a lot of position players that get the surgery, get the procedure, at least compared to pitchers. And, you know, I believe Bryce Harper also had a Tommy John, and Bryce Harper is Bryce Harper. He's been able to rebound and be the player that he was before, but he's also Bryce Harper, who's played in the major leagues for X amount of years and is going to the Hall of Fame. Jason Dominguez is not at that point yet. And I think the smart thing to do, if the Yankees are in the same roster situation that they're in right now, is to give Jason as many at-bats in AAA as possible so that he gets his feet back on the ground. He's playing baseball, whatever things he has to come back to or get over or rebound from physically from the procedure and now playing everyday baseball. I think all those things need to be taken care of before you just throw him in the fire, unless the situation calls for it. I mean, I think there's too much talent. There's too much potential to just rush him to the 24 roster just because he had a good 8 games last year. And I think that there's a chance for him to be a really impactful player in the future, but you're going to have to play this right if you're the Yankees. And I think he needs at bats. He needs a spring training, essentially. I mean, he didn't have a spring training either. I know he was doing some stuff, but it's not like he was playing in games. He was still rehabbing. I mean, I think that there's a lot of steps that he should take to help him be in a position where he can be that impact player, where those 8 games turn into a good season, turns into another good season, and it becomes a core player for the Yankees. So the Yankees are covering in the outfield right now. They're 12-4. I don't see them falling off a cliff unless everybody gets hurt. There's really no need to rush Jason or kind of shoehorn him into the roster at this point. I mean, they don't need him, to be quite honest. So as long as a big league club is doing what they're supposed to be doing, you're buying time for Jason to get ready so that when he is on the team, he's the guy that we want him to be. And I think that that's more important than fans' desire to see him play again in the Bronx. I mean, you want him to have a nice, long, impactful career, not just let me see him because I'm excited to see him. Not trying to be a downer on it, but I think that there's a long-term view that needs to be taken to protect him and also to help the team.
Yeah, I mean, he's also just 21 years old. His development is not done. And if he was on the 26-man roster when he comes back, he's probably not playing every single day. You mentioned it, but like, you want him playing every single day. And where he's going to do that is in the minor leagues. And there's nothing wrong with that. You know, I think people may get carried away and like, oh, like he's so good, like he needs to be on the 26-man roster. get rid of Verdugo. But Verdugo's, you know, had a few years now of being at least an average major league player, and that's fine. Like, you don't, you're not going to have superstars at every single position. If Verdugo's doing his job in left field, you know, his on base is around 340, 350. That's a productive player who can help the Yankees win games. Whereas with Dominguez, there's still some development left for him to be an everyday player in the majors. And again, the sample size is so small. So I think what's best for Dominguez, honestly, is probably starting in the minor leagues and, you know, coming up if necessary.
I agree. And hopefully he's healthy, and hopefully he'll have a great career in pinstripes. So that's what we're all hoping for, and we'll see how it plays out. So we're going to end the mailbag with some fun questions that I think are right up Chris's alley, not necessarily mine. So Chris can take this over, especially coming off of his great annual piece on the concessions at Yankee Stadium. So this is all, this is Chris's time to shine with these questions. So James Rogers asks, what do each of you rank as your top three food options currently at the stadium? And we're going to go back to back here with the questions. Especially because Chris asked for people to ask spicy questions, and Michael Held took it very seriously. And he wants to know, in honor of Conan O'Brien's appearance on Hot Ones this weekend, which player on this team would you expect to be able to tolerate the spiciest wings? This is a really dumb question. There's no dumb questions, Michael. I look forward to a thorough investigation. So, Chris, the floor is yours.
We'll start with the top three concession items. I think number one, the Judge Burger, the 99 Burger, it's a really good – it's good. Like, there's – I mean, if you're in Manhattan or New York City, like, it's one of the better burgers I've had, honestly, in the city.
Oh, okay.
Nice. It's legit. And I believe last year was like $19.99, which is like cheaper than some places in Manhattan, honestly. Like, some burgers in Manhattan are like $27, which is absurd. I recommend that. New item this year, the Sweet Spot Bowl. It's carne asada, rice, beans, plantains. Very good. Highly recommend. And number three, probably the cheesy garlic bread with the meatballs. I mean, I love garlic bread. I love cheese. I love meatballs. I mean, it's like three things I absolutely love. So those are my three. Also, the chicken wings, they're new chicken wings this year. I think it's like some brown sugar sauce.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, it was for stadium food. Again, like, all this is relative because we're talking about stadium food.
Yeah, stadium food, yeah.
But the chicken wings were, like, very good. Like, surprisingly good. Like, they had a crisp on the skin. The sauce was like not too sweet. There was like a little kick on in the sauce. Mm-hmm. So I would say, so give you a bonus. Like, I would choose those four.
I don't really have anything to add to this, because when I go to the games, most of the time I'm just watching the game. I'm not even like really trying to eat. I'm trying to go to the chicken spot after the game. You know, I'm trying to get a snack box. The Bronx for me just wants to get the snack box. So sometimes I get food there, sometimes I don't. So Chris is definitely more of the authority on it. I will say, though, the restaurant with the legend seats, excellent. Just
I still haven't been. Yeah,
oh, you got to go. Excellent. Excellent.
Well, I don't know if you're listening to this and you have Legends tickets, I'll skip the press box.
I got you. Yeah. Next time, if they drop in my lap, I will let you know.
All right. All right. Sounds good. I've heard nothing but great things.
Oh, no, it's good.
My fiance is an attorney here in the city, and her company, her law firm has a suite in the Legends section. Oh, nice. But she hasn't, the tickets haven't fallen in her lap yet.
Yeah, I'm lucky to know a famous director that sometimes is like, yo, here's the tickets. So,
A humble brag.
maybe one day I'll just be able to get those tickets for myself and anybody could come with me. Yeah. Well, not anybody, I don't know. But you'll definitely be at the top of the list so we can go to the restaurant.
I appreciate it. I usually, with the concessions, like I usually don't eat the concessions because I think the press box dining food in Yankee Stadium is really good. Mm-hmm. Like they have a lot of different options. Sometimes there's like lamb, sausage, and peppers.
Wow.
Usually not a press box option.
Right.
So I honestly think it's good, and it's $15 all you can eat. I mean, it's a great deal.
Yeah. All right. So we'll end with the spicy wings eater. Who's your guy?
I was thinking about it. I mean, and I don't even know if it's correct, but I'm going to go with Jose Trevino. You know, he grew up in South Texas, close to the border in Mexico. I don't know if they're eating a lot of spicy food in Corpus Christi, Texas, but Trevino's my guess. I could be totally wrong. He may only like bland food. I have no idea. I've never talked to Trevino about this, but he's my pick.
We got to get him on the podcast. so we can ask him that. And then I can also make fun of him for being a Cowboys fan and always losing to the Niners. So we'll try to get Jose on here and we'll ask him how he feels about spicy wings.
Yeah, we'll mark that down.
We'll mark it down.
that'll be the first question we ask.
So thank you, everyone, for your questions. We appreciate it. Thank you for sending them. Thank you for supporting us. That wraps up episode 5 of the Views from 314 Feet podcast. You can find us on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Please leave us a 5-star review if you feel inclined to do so. Leave some comments. Let us know how we're doing. We think we're doing pretty good, but this is for you, the listener, and, you know, we're open to all comments. So, Chris, any final words before we get out of here?
No, I think it's going to be a fun week in Yankee land. You know, 3 against the Blue Jays, and then this weekend at home, 3 against the Rays. Good tests, both of them for the Yankees. You know, 6 division games. It's going to be a fun, exciting week. Also, bobblehead day on Saturday. Aaron Judge, 62. It was postponed last year. It got rained out. Looking forward to adding that to the collection.
I'm sure that the line for that game will start at 6 o'clock in the morning. So
yeah, it's going to be if you want a bobblehead, you got to show up. Yeah, you got to show up early. You can't think you're getting a bobblehead and you walk into the stadium at 1 o'clock.
Yeah, you need to camp out like back in the day to get some sneakers to bring this episode full circle with sneakers. So, follow us, subscribe on every one of your favorite podcast platforms. Give us a 5-star review if you feel inclined to do so. Leave a comment. We appreciate it. We appreciate the support as always. And we will speak to you on Friday. We'll have another bonus episode to get us ready for the race series. So we'll speak to you on Friday.